Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. We're talking about the famous 14 lines of the sonnet, of sonnet form, worked for centuries by poets in rage, in love, in rapture, sorrow, defeat. The sonnet has endured from the thou and thee genius of Shakespeare to the in-your-face humor and snit of Billy Collins and Bernadette Mayer. You jerk, you didn't call me up, she writes, and off we go. This hour, On Point, five centuries of sonnets still flowing strong from the pen tips of poets. We're talking today with two wonderful poets who are also editors of a great and purposeful new collection. It's The Making of a Sonnet, a Norton anthology, edited by Evan Boland and Edward Hirsch. Evan Boland is an Irish poet and creative writing director at Stanford University. Her books of poetry include Domestic Violence and Against Love Poetry. She joins us today from Stanford, California. Evan Boland, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
American poet Edward Hirsch is author of seven books of poetry, including Wild Gratitude and Special Orders, and of the best-selling book, How to Read a Poem. He joins us from New York City. Edward Hirsch, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
We have so much great poetry to read today, and I can't wait to dive into it. But just give us, Edward, if you would, first, the little definition. What's a sonnet?
Well, it turns out that a sonnet is a little more complicated to explain what a sonnet is than people usually think. But I would say the general notion of the sonnet is that it's a 14-line poem in Maine with a structure that that turns.
Turns from the first eight to the last six and so.
The traditional Petrarchan sonnet begins with eight lines and then turns what in Italians called a volta, the turn, and then it concludes with another six. And that begins the history of the sonnet, and I think our book tries to show that the history expands that version of what a sonnet is to make it as expansive as it can be, always using the 14-line base, I would say.
Evan Boland, Petrarchan, take us back to that in Petrarch. Before it leaps to Shakespeare and English, we have its beginnings in this little song. Who was Petrarch? What did he introduce here?
Well, he was the Italian poet who I think was one of the first poets who really domesticated that form. He made it popular throughout Europe. I mean, he wrote the love songs that inspired many later poets, especially in England. And it's he, I think, as Ed was saying there, who probably gave that volta its first kind of gleaming form so that, you know, you could see how the sonnet turned. There's a lot of anecdotal talk about that. Some people say that it was built on the old scholarly disputes that were going on at that time in Europe, where you had a proposition and then you had an answer. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, that's true. But I think it was the passion and the intensity of Petrarch's work, his love for Laura, that caught people's attention and made them feel this form could carry that kind of fervor.
It leapt to Shakespeare and beyond, and we will read, I promise we'll read. But Evan Boland, how do you describe what has made this such a durable poetic form? Why so captivating over so many centuries? Now, five centuries worth you have in this book. Why this form?
Because I think it's a portable, fugitive form. It's been surprising. It's crept out of courts. It's ended up in midnights with people who've lost their hopes and their spouses. It's also turned to be major political rhetoric in the hands of people like Wordsworth. I don't think anyone could have thought this little piece of real estate of 14 lines could, as Ed has said, have expanded so much. But I think what makes it powerful is that this particular form has shown itself to be extraordinarily resilient, both in public and private situations.
Edward Hirsch, we want to begin to hear it, and we will talk in depth about what makes it work. Take us back to the old style, if you would, first. You've got one in the Shakespearean style, but not from Shakespeare. This is Sir Walter Raleigh to his son. We should give us a little setup and read it.
Sir Walter Raleigh was one of the great early sonneteers, and he wrote just a chilling poem, which I've always loved. It was an exemplum of the Shakespearean form. It was probably written when he was under arrest in the Tower of London, and it's I especially like this poem because it's so closely reasoned. And the sonnet was originated by a group of notaries in a Sicilian court, and there's always been something about it that has the quality of the argument. Raleigh uses that argumentative form quite brilliantly in this poem addressed to his son. It employs a really dark wit since he's trying to keep his son from the gallows, which he himself will be facing. Mm. Sir Walter Raleigh to his son. Three things there be that prosper up apace and flourished, whilst thou grow asunder far, but on a day they meet all in one place, and when they meet they one another mar. And they be these, the wood, the weed, the wag. The wood is that which makes the gallows tree. The weed is that which strings the hangman's bag. The wag, my pretty knave, betokeneth thee. Mark well, dear boy, while these assemble not. Green springs in the tree, hemp grows, the wag is wild. But when they meet, it makes the timber rot. It frets the halter and it chokes the child. Then bless thee and beware. And let us pray, we part not with thee at this meeting day.
And so the son is advised, and pull out of that. What is the heart of Sir Walter Raleigh's advice? We don't get to read it. We only get to hear it once. You have the advantage.
I know it can be a little complicated because of the Elizabethan language. Well, his advice is, here are three things that are innocuous by themselves, the wood, the weed, and the wag. Mm. And then it turns out, but the wood can make a gallows. The weed is that which can hang the hangman's, which can string the hangman's bag. And the wag, the one who wags his tongue, can be the one who gets hung. So he's going, make sure these three things don't assemble, my son. Don't be a wild wag, because the hemp will grow, the tree will spring up, and you can get yourself choked.
What a wonderful image of him sitting there, essentially imprisoned, writing in sonnet form to his son. Oh, we just want to keep that going. Ivan, I wish you'd read one, and we are going to get very contemporary before we're finished here. But take us back. You've got one from Wordsworth that you might share with us.
I have, and I think it makes a turn that is pretty characteristic. I mean, Wordsworth had an illegitimate daughter to whom he was immensely attached, didn't see often, takes it in this poem from the broad kind of pastoral sense of a lovely evening to being with this child. It is a beauteous evening, Camonfree is the first line title of it. Mm. It is a beauteous evening, calm and free. The holy time is quiet as a nun. Breathless with adoration, the broad sun is sinking down in its tranquility. The gentleness of heaven is on the sea. Listen, the mighty being is awake, and doth with his eternal motion make a sound like thunder everlastingly. Dear child, dear girl that walkest with me here, if thou appearest untouched by solemn thought, thy nature is not therefore less divine. Thou liest in Abraham's bosom all the year, and worshipst at the temple's inner shrine, God being with thee when we know it not.
Take us to his turn, to what he sets up and how he resolves.
Well, I think of it is in some ways the very real central romantic propaganda that the outside world can be the inner world as well, and that the sacred doesn't have to be found in four walls or in a church. And the child who's with him, he says, if you don't appear to be thinking seriously, it doesn't mean your nature is less divine. Thou liest in Abraham's bosom all the year. And so God being with thee when we know it not. So it's this very broad, very warm, very affirmative sense of the child as being just as sacred as the landscape, but beautifully done in this small sort of capsule.
And there's Wordsworth a couple of hundred years after Shakespeare. Edward Hirsch, everyone knows how Shakespeare took the sonnet from Petrarch and made it into something very, very English language in its heart, but also maybe wrap the English language around it. How do you see that?
Well, it turns out that that Italian is just much more fluent in rhymes than English. Ossip Mandelstam said that Italian is like baby talk. Everything rhymes with everything else. And when Shakespeare sort of imported or helped to import the sonnet and built on what Wyatt and Surrey had brought over from Italian into English, he needed a poem that would be more flexible in terms of rhyming, because the Petrarchan sonnet really turns on very few rhymes. And so he came up with a new scheme, or they came up together or independently, that all worked on a new scheme where the individual quatrains, the four-line stanzas, rhymed within themselves but didn't rhyme interstitially, and that allowed them to just use more rhymes, which they desperately needed to make a more fluent argument.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about 500 years of sonnets and why it's much of the world's favorite form of poem, 14 Lines of Magic. Poets Evan Boland and Edward Hirsch join me. They are editors together of the new The Making of a Sonnet, a big, fat, juicy slice of sonnets from all over, across time and place. It's a Norton anthology. Here's E.E. Cummings in his own voice. It's an archival recording, reading a sonnet from his 1926 poem collection, Is Five.
Next, of course, God, America, I love you, land of the pilgrims, and so forth. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early my country 'tis of? Centuries come and go and are no more, what of it we should worry? In every language, even deaf and dumb, thy sons acclaim your glorious name. By gurry, by jingo, by gee, by gosh, by gum. Why talk of beauty? What could be more beautiful than these heroic, happy dead who rushed like lions to the roaring slaughter? They did not stop to think, they died instead. Then shall the voice of liberty be mute? He spoke and drank rapidly a glass of water.
E. Cummings in 1926, having at least his collection from then, and having a little fun there with a very old form. Bill's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you. This is one of your finest hours, an hour of sonnets. My God, I've died and gone to heaven without
Doesn't get better for you, huh? Good.
Oh, my Lord. I'm going to make 2 points, by the way. Number one, it's interesting to find out the types of people that have written first-rate, great sonnets who you least expect it from. So Walter Raleigh was one of them. Mm. Wilfred Owen of World War I fame, one of the war poets, wrote quite a few of them. King James, I'm not particularly fond of his sonnets, but I must say they're exceptionally well written. Mary, Queen of Scots. One of my absolute favorites is Oscar Wilde. I mean, you couldn't write a better sonnet than he did. However, I've got to say this, regardless of now or in the future, Shakespeare reigns supreme. I mean, his imagery in his sonnets is just nothing short of incredible. He takes an emotion, and he absolutely distills it to its purest essence. And in the process, getting to the imagery, he gets into, like, marble and bronze, and he'll be talking about a summer day, and he'll be talking about rosebuds and, wheat fields and everything else, and it all rivets you as you're reading it.
Bill, hang on, and yes, Shakespeare is all over it. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes...
But I alone beweep my outcast state and trouble death heaven with my footless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate. I can go on.
Well, you're loaded for bear, but I want to get Evan and Edward into this. Evan, let me ask you, is this You Hear Bill's Love, and it's widely shared. Is that considered hip among poets to love sonnets, or is it considered fuddy-duddy, despite how gorgeous?
No, I think it's more the first than the second. I really agree with the caller. I think most poets regard this as bedrock. It's a really powerful treasure load in poetry, and I don't think that anybody regards it as something that is over or wouldn't be done again, or is a cold game form. It's a very powerful way in which poet after poet has found an expression for powerful feeling.
Bill, you're wonderful, and we appreciate that so much. We'd love to give you 16 starts and see where you went with them. Ivan, you and Edward write that you took a personal approach to the sonnets here, and you take us back to your own Irish roots, your sort of early attitudes toward the sonnet and the sort of English suzerainty over the sonnet, and how you, if I read you right, sort of saw sonnets break out of that with one from Patrick Cavanagh. I wish you'd explain that journey you took with the sonnet.
Yeah, I was very young. I was 18 or 19, and I'm afraid I did think, probably in a simplistic way, that yes, sonnets had been written by Shakespeare and Milton. They'd come out of the great British court tradition. They were largely a British form. And then this Irish poet, Patrick Cavanagh, a very rural poet, a lyric poet, come from a very small farm in 1939, the year when the Munich Accords were signed at the start of the Second World War, or previous to it. He'd come to Dublin, and he was in doubt as to whether his rural background could ever matter. And he wrote this beautiful sonnet called Epic, very cherished in Ireland, and I'll read it to Please. Show that you know, what is local is universal. Chose the sonnet to do it. Epic. I have lived in important places, times when great events were decided. Who owned that half a rood of rock in no man's land, surrounded by our pitchfork-armed claims? I heard the Duffys shouting, "Damn your soul," and old McCabe stripped to the waist, seen step the plot, defying blue cast steel. Here is the march along these iron stones. That was the year of the Munich bother. Which was more important? I inclined to lose my faith in Ballyrush and Gorchin till Homer's ghost came whispering to my mind. He said, "I made the Iliad from such a local row. Gods make their own importance."
Patrick Cavanagh's epic. And with that, you heard Ireland kind of making its claim on this form.
Well, I think I heard that the sonnet was infinitely adaptable and that it is absolutely not pinned to one tradition, one canon, one court, one place, that it finds its path to the poet who can use it at very intimate moments, very unsanctioned, and that in that way it is really the most, in my view, democratic of the forms.
It's a wonderful, wonderful sonnet there, epic. Edward Hirsch, you and Ivan describe in the course of the anthology how the sonnet has had its sort of heyday and its moment when it was in retreat. Give us a sense of that arc across this great expanse of time that you're traversing here.
You mean across the centuries?
Yes, please.
Well, I mean, the astonishing thing about the sonnet is that it seems to move from country to country and from language to language quite fluently, and that it began in Sicily in 1235 or 1230 or somewhere in there, and it moved rapidly to France and eventually to England. But if you go to Israel, if you go to Arab republics, if you go to Poland, each of these languages, each of these countries has its own remarkable history. There's a French history of the sonnet. There's a German history of the sonnet. There's an American history of the sonnet. And the sonnet also moves across the centuries. And it really took great life in the 17th century England, which was one of the high points of the English sonnet. And then for some reason, no one knows exactly why, it really fell into disrepute in the 18th century. And Samuel Johnson has very many funny things to say about the sonnet. For example, he defines a sonneteer as a small poet in contempt.
Who brought it back? Who brought it back from that low? Trust Johnson to lay it low.
It was really the 19th century that recognized, it was really Wordsworth and other poets of the romantic poets of the 19th century who realized that Milton had written some of the greatest sonnets in the English language. And they began to imitate Milton. And so it was really Wordsworth, Coleridge, Keats, and others who began to bring the sonnet back into English, in the English language in the 19th century, where it flourished. Their whole anthology anthologies of the poet of just the Romantic sonnet. And then the Victorians picked it up, and it's never died since then. It's been extremely lively all through the 19th, 20th, and now into the 21st century.
And speaking of that range, you have a wonderful sonnet I think you must have included here from your own reading by Robert Hayden, Those Winter Sundays, taking it right around the world and into Detroit and the hands of an African-American poet. I wish you'd introduce us and maybe read it. Edward.
That would be my pleasure. I mean, Ivan's point is a good one. One of the things is when you're young, you associate the sonnet with the halls of power. Mm. And as you get older and you read more powerfully and more widely, you begin to see that the sonnet has been used by all different kinds of writers, experimental writers as well as traditional writers, innovative writers, writers of color, writers writing from the margins, that they engage in the language of the sonnet and turn the sonnet to their own ends. Mm. Robert Hayden was a wonderful 20th century African-American poet who grew up in Detroit, where I once lived and taught at Wayne State University. And this poem, Those Winter Sundays, takes us back to his childhood in Detroit. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices?
Oh, just fantastic. Just great.
Just a beautifully intimate poem about the things that he remembers that his father did that he had sort of neglected and overlooked, and in memory come back to him as he remembers the small intimacies of his father's generosity.
And the blue-black cold of a working-class Detroit childhood and adulthood right there.
And then it enlarges to that sense after all these small things of his father shining his shoes and arranging his clothes and clothes and making the fire for him. And he speaks indifferently to him. And then it comes back to him years later. He enlarges it to make that love's austere and lonely offices, the things we do on behalf of love.
Just beautiful. Let's go to Marta in Bennington, Vermont. Hi, Marta. You're on the air.
Hello, bravo, what a marvelous way to kick off Poetry Month.
Oh, yes, it's National Poetry Month. Let's go, hallelujah.
Yes. Well, I am a poet, and I write sonnets. I have one if you'd like to hear it.
Sure, dive in.
I just finished writing it yesterday.
Okay.
I once had time to pick the cones of pines up off the ground, and notice how the mosses beneath the trees differed in their designs. No cares had I for daylight's gains and losses. So as the tides pulled back to re-advance, I'd watch the endless wavelets choreograph a solitary piper's scuttle dance, all up and down the sunlit shore and laugh. But now my turret window lets me see a bird's nest empty and exposed, clinging to naked branches of the old ash tree. Its architect long since has stopped singing, and I feel a chill coming to grip the earth, braced for its long, inevitable dearth.
How wonderful. Marta is so generous to let you us up into your turret window with you. What's your family name, if I may ask, Marta?
My what?
Your family name.
My family name is Finch, Marta Finch. I come from a long line of poets. But I have a question also.
Yes, please.
I would like to know, it seems to me that we are on the brink of new movements in poetry. We've had free verse now for 100 years, and I'd like to know whether your guests, feel that the modern ear is ready to hear form again after all this time. And I'd also like to know what is it that you can do to modernize a sonnet and still keep it as a sonnet? Can you get rid of rhymes? Can you start the lines with no capital letters, no punctuation? Or does that mean that it's no longer a sonnet?
Wonderful, both questions. Evan, first to you on this issue of free verse versus form. Do you sense a hunger to get back to form, or is it all everything now?
I'm not sure that it ever went away. I mean, one of the other names for free verse, which I maybe liked a little bit more, was open form. And I think that a lot of the 20th century and 21st century have been made not so much by form or not form, as by that conversation between open and closed forms. I mean, the sonnet learned a huge amount from the conversational and anarchic modernism that went into some open form. And at the same time, I think open form has learned a tremendous amount of intensity and pacing from closed form. So I think it's that conversation. You can see it in the sonnet. I mean, there are poems there, especially contemporary ones, which have learned a great deal from open form.
And Edward, what about just how free, how open can a poet be and still have it be a sonnet? I mean, I see you've got John Updike in here very mischievously. He's just got and a little, he's out there in love's rubber armor. I come to you. And then just a dribble of letters down the
page.
He's
got the rhyme scheme.
Yes,
it's just the rhyme scheme,
right,
as if you fill in the blanks. Well, I mean, we have a section called The Sonnet Goes to Different Lengths of sonnets that are not even 14 lines long. That, I mean, Milton wrote what he called a tailed sonnet, where he lengthened the sonnet to 20 lines. And Gerard Manley Hopkins wrote what he called a curtal sonnet, where he broke the sonnet down to three quarters of a traditional sonnet. I mean, poets have really pushed the limits of what the sonnet is. I mean, I would say that as soon as you say that sonnets have to rhyme, then poets are going to come along and say, well, this is a sonnet and it doesn't rhyme. As soon as you say the first line has to be capitalized, then poets in the 20th century, Wallace Stevens or William Carlos Williams, is going to come along and show that the first line doesn't have to be capitalized. So I think poets have often played with the nature of the form to keep expanding and changing it to see what element actually is absolutely essential to the sonnet form. It turns out 14 lines isn't always necessary for a sonnet. It turns out rhyming isn't always necessary. It turns out meter isn't always necessary.
I love the opening of Billy Collins' American Sonnet. He's talking about sort of a postcard approach. We do not speak like Petrarch or wear a hat like Spencer. And it is not 14 lines like furrows in a small, carefully plowed field, but the picture postcard, a poem on vacation that forces us to sing our songs in little rooms or pour our sentiments into measuring cups we write on the back of a waterfall or lake. Billy Collins' American Sonnet. Opening up there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about 500 years of sonnets with poets Evan Boland and Edward Hirst. They're editors of the new Norton anthology, The Making of a Sonnet. Here is T.S. Eliot, 1946, reading the opening sonnet from The Fire Sermon, part 3 of his masterpiece, The Wasteland.
The river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. The nymphs are departed. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. The river bears no empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, or other testimony of summer nights. The nymphs are departed, and their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors, departed, have left no addresses. By the waters of Leman I sat down and wept. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. Sweet Thames, run softly, for I speak not loud or long. But at my back in a cold blast I hear the rattle of the bones and chuckle spread from ear to ear.
T.S. Eliot, 1946, The Fire Sermon. Susan's calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, Susan, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Enjoying your program immensely.
Good.
Just wanted to say the caller earlier that had just finished her sonnet yesterday, it just brought tears to my eyes.
Marta Finch, you went for it. Great.
Oh, the poetry is music of the soul. And it just, from childhood, when I used to read my child craft books, I loved it. And I loved the Brownings. They're my favorites. And it just really moves me.
Susan, we hear that, and we love it. You make a poem just sharing it, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Evan, I wish you'd read for us from Edna St. Vincent Millay. You've got a whole section in here of poems, sonnets, that address sonnetry, if that's a word.
Yeah, yes. I mean, and she has a wonderful poem called I Will Put Chaos into 14 Lines. It's a witty poem because in many ways what the sonneteers like Milton were trying to do was to put a sort of world order into 14 lines, mm-hmm. and she reverses that. I will put chaos into 14 lines and keep him there, and let him thence escape, if he be lucky. Let him twist and ape, flood fire and demon. His adroit designs will strain to nothing in the strict confines of this sweet order, where in pious rape I hold his essence and amorphous shape, till he with order mingles and combines. Past are the hours, the years of our duress, his arrogance, our awful servitude. I have him. He is nothing more nor less than something simple, not yet understood. I shall not even force him to confess or answer. I will only make him good.
Edna St. Vincent Millay, I will put chaos into 14 lines. What about the poet's conversation about sonnets over time, Evan? She wants to bring chaos in here, but when poets write, we hear what she has to say. In general, what's the message been? I suppose that's impossible to say in general.
In this poem?
In this one, but when poets sit and write sonnets on sonnets.
I think the sonnet, at its best and most powerful, whether it's a private or a public sonnet, has often been a very emotive, warm interior conversation in the poet's life. You know, like Milton when he's blind saying, well, you know, why should I have to do these things when I'm blind? But wait, you know, they also serve who only stand and wait. It's this to and fro in a poet's life. It's there in Shakespeare. It's there in Millay. It's there in this sense of some drama brought into these 14 lines by the poet, that interior argument people in all parts of life often have with themselves gets put into this form. And when it's put into this form, we see it there in all its drama and sometimes its pain and its glamour. And we recognize something of ourselves in that interior dialogue.
I wish you'd read one more that goes to a very intimate moment in the life of a very famous poet, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, The Cross of Snow. This growing right out of tragedy in his own life. Could you share that history with us and then go to the poem?
Yeah, I love this poem. This poem is Longfellow, who is thought of in many more popular national contexts. Didn't marry for a long time. Then he married his wife and he were very united. But then when their daughter was 15, she went to put the curling tongs in the fire and a spark caught her skirt, and she went on fire, and she died 2 days later. In fact, he bore a scar on his face all his life that was covered by beard, but from trying to put those flames out.
That had caught his wife's dress on fire when she was...
Yes, it's caught his wife's dress, and she was burned and died a few days later.
Amazing.
And he went back 18 years later, and he wrote this poem, The Cross of Snow, which is about bearing this mark of pain all his life, like a winter mountain or a mountain that in the far west, as he says, never loses its snow in any season. And I think it proves how deeply the sonnet can go into the most intimate moments, The Cross of Snow.
Mm.
In the long, sleepless watches of the night, a gentle face, the face of one long dead, looks at me from the wall, where round its head the night lamp casts a halo of pale light. Here, in this room, she died. And soul more white, never through martyrdom of fire, was led to its repose. Nor can in books be read the legend of a life more benedite. There is a mountain in the distant west that, sun-defying, in its deep ravines, displays a cross of snow upon its side. Such is the cross I wear upon my breast these 18 years, through all the changing scenes and seasons, changeless since the day she died.
It's just, it leaves you speechless.
It's a beautiful poem.
Longfellow's The Cross of Snow, and to know the story behind it, wow, just beautiful. Let's take a call. Franny in Acton, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi. I did a self-tutorial this week inspired by Garrison Keillor's sonnet contest.
Oh, good.
I started Googling how to write sonnets and heard Italian, the web is amazing, I heard Italian sonnets and Shakespearean, and I loved Elizabeth Barrett Browning's especially. But I was inspired to write this one, which is lighter than some.
Okay, you're fresh to it. Let's hear it. Franny, fresh on the sonnet front.
Sonnet about the joy of writing. The way the rhythm gets inside my head and won't come out until my poem is done. And even then, I find I'm being led by magic muses marching dum-de-dum. That I ignore the hour and let my son chat on, enthusiastic, shrill with pride, about a poem that is his favorite one, the best so far, but safely hid inside his notebook, soft with words erased and then rewritten when they fall again to him, in literary rain that patters like a friend, on roof, on head, with plan or on a whim. You'd think the words would shrink from noise and clatter, but no, they eat my life and come out fatter.
Dum-de-dum. All right. Franny, do you think you're going to keep it up?
Oh, yes. I love the structure. It's really helpful to have goals like structure and rhyme. I know I don't have to rhyme. I know there are many forms, but it's exciting to try to fit it in.
Dum-de-dum, you're off to the races. Franny, thanks very much. Edward Hirsch, take us. I think there's a Robert Frost sonnet that maybe led you to fall in love with the sonnet.
Well, when I was a teenager, of course I'd heard about Frost, but I didn't have much of a feeling for him because I had sort of gotten the idea of Frost as a country farmer, and it didn't much interest me. Mm. I mean, I was starting to write poetry myself, and I somehow had the idea that many people still have, because I was reading Whitman and Ginsberg, that American poets don't write in traditional forms. It turns out the evidence goes completely against that, and that almost all American poets have written in traditional forms. Even someone like William Carlos Williams, who basically didn't like the sonnet, eventually wrote one and was converted to it by Merrill Moore. Mm-hmm. So when I was starting to write poetry and I was writing entirely in free verse and just thinking of my own sort of desperate feelings as a teenager, mm-hmm. I came across this poem by Robert Frost called Acquainted with the Night. I have been one acquainted with the night. I have walked out in rain and back in rain. I have outwalked the furthest city light. I have looked down the saddest city lane. I have passed by the watchman on his beat and dropped my eyes, unwilling to explain. I have stood still and stopped the sound of feet when far away an interrupted cry came over houses from another street, but not to call me back or say goodbye. And further still, at an unearthly height, one luminary clock against the sky proclaimed the time was neither wrong nor right. I have been one acquainted with the night.
Robert Frost, I have walked out in rain and back in rain. And can you remember the line or which of these wonderful images grabbed the teenage Edward Hirsch and brought him into the Church of the Sonnet?
Well, I would say the Temple of the Sonnet.
Temple, fine. Glorious temple.
I like the title line, I have been one acquainted with the night, because I like the formality of it and then the underlying secrecy and loneliness.
Yeah. And take us right on. I just want you to keep reading. You've got one from Cesar Vallejo, Black Stone Lying on a White Stone. This gets much more contemporary. What's the story here?
He was a great Peruvian poet who lived in Paris and died in poverty in the, I think, 1930s, early 1930s, heartbroken. And he used the sonnet. I mean, he was an extraordinary experimental poet writing in Spanish. And this poem, Black Stone Lying on a White Stone, he predicts his own death. It's translated by Robert Bly and John Knopfel. I will die in Paris on a rainy day, on some day I can already remember. I will die in Paris, and I don't step aside, perhaps on a Thursday, as today is Thursday, in autumn. It will be a Thursday because today, Thursday, setting down these lines, I have put my upper arm bones on wrong. And never so much today have I found myself with all the road ahead of me alone. Cesar Vallejo is dead. Everyone beat him, although he never does anything to them. They beat him hard with a stick and hard also with a rope. These are the witnesses, the Thursdays, and the bones of my arms, the solitude and the rain and the roads. You know, there's an extraordinary turn in this poem where he predicts his own death. I will die in Paris, and he predicts the day it will be. And then right where the traditional sonnet turns after the eight lines, he turns to the third person and uses his own name and says, Cesar Vallejo is dead, as if he's already been dead. It's really an extraordinary turn in which a poet turns himself from the first person into the third person, from a subject into an object.
Everyone beat him, although he never does anything to them. They beat him hard with a stick and hard also with the rope. There's a wonderful line you quote in here from Leigh Hunt, Boland, saying, every mood of mind can be indulged in a sonnet. Every kind of reader appeal to you can make love in a sonnet. You can laugh in a sonnet. You can lament in it, can narrate or describe, can rebuke, can admire, can pray. I read that, and it's thrilling, but is that not true of every form of poetry, Evan?
Yeah, I think you could put up a very strong argument that many, many poems have an ability to turn around. For instance, the Villanelle, which is a harvest song, has been adapted. But the sonnet is very different, I think, and broader. I mean, it has had very long histories in countries that were essentially empires, like England, and deep and powerful histories in small places with people like Shakespeare, who were no sense part of empire. He was a country boy, anxious and alone in London when he wrote his sonnets. I do think that most poems can be claimed to be adaptable, but the sonnet's ability to call people into its structure with an extraordinary variety of moods and lives and narratives, I think that is unique in poetry.
Let's hear one more from Billy Collins, who's playing with form and content in his poem titled Sonnet. Here he is reading live in New York in 2005.
All we need is 14 lines. Well, 13 now. And after this one, just a dozen, to launch a little ship on love's storm-tossed seas. Then only 10 more left, like rows of beans. How easily it goes, unless you get Elizabethan and insist the iambic bongos must be played and rhymes positioned at the ends of lines, one for every station of the cross. But hang on here while we make the turn into the final six, where all will be resolved, where longing and heartache will find an end, where Laura will tell Petrarch to put down his pen, take off those crazy medieval tights, blow out the lights, and come at last to bed.
Billy Collins reading in 2005 with his iambic bongos and crazy medieval tights. What a pleasure. What a terrific pleasure. Where did it leave you? 500 years worth here, Edward Hirsch, and so many sonnets. Did it leave you wanting to write them or daunted and off into free open verse country?
Well, I've always wanted to write them, but it left me with a sense that I didn't have at the beginning of this project of just the extraordinary expansiveness of the form. I really didn't know just how extraordinarily detailed and how rich it was and how many different kinds of sonnets there were. I really didn't know how expansive the history was. And it left me marveling at the remarkable way that the sonnet has persisted across the centuries.
And Evan, we've just got 20 seconds. How did you go away from this big project?
Same as Ed, just marveling at that incredible landscape of poetry.
Well, it's a beautiful landscape to fly over and to dive into, and you've helped us do that so wonderfully today. Evan Boland and Edward Hirsch, editor of The Making of a Sonnet, a Norton Anthology, thank you so much to both of you for being with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.com. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.